Hours after losing another election lawsuit, U.S. President Donald Trump attacks Joe Biden for making cabinet choices. The Israeli military launches artillery and aerial attacks on several positions in the besieged Gaza Strip. Japan and South Korea say they may reimpose coronavirus restrictions amid fears of a new wave of the pandemic. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Badr Zajafek. Good to have you with us. Now, starting with the United States, President Donald Trump has expressed anger at Joe Biden's rush to announce his cabinet lineup. Trump says that his Democratic rival is moving too quickly in forming a cabinet. The Republican president says that his legal team is still fighting to prove voter fraud in the November 3rd presidential election. Biden, who has been projected the winner by the media, is set to unveil his picks this week. Trump has so far refused to concede defeat and continues to file suits in states he believes fraudulent votes were cast. In the latest blow to Trump's camp, a federal court in Pennsylvania has rejected another case brought in by his lawyers. Also in Wisconsin, state officials have accused Trump's observers of obstructing a recount of the votes in the state's largest county. The U.S. presidential election has polarized the nation, but a new poll suggesting it's just the latest problem in an already deeply divided society. The poll reveals widespread feelings of disunity, but also little faith that the country will heal anytime soon. Rami Mazahari has more.
The U.S. presidential election remains unresolved, but what seems crystal clear is that the nation is more divided at any time than since the 1960s, or perhaps even the 1860s. A new poll found that nearly 80% of America says they are deeply divided on its most foundational values. Whoever is inaugurated in January will face a deeply mistrustful and disbelieving public. As the poll also finds that just 30% of Americans believe the country will grow more united in 2021. For a nation which is the richest in the world and which faces no serious external threat, such levels of disharmony are shocking even to many Americans themselves.
The far right, that's really come from almost like Trumpism, if that movement still stays strong, we can see more conflict in the next 4 years. And I think it's really just dependent on how Joe Biden kind of handles the next 4 years, and also what kind of information is really getting flown out of the far right and whether that gets filtered or not or whether that gets spread very rapidly.
Distrust is not something which grows overnight. Many attribute the division to the American liberals' obsession with so-called identity politics, which divides and redivides people into smaller and smaller tribes based on gender, race, ethnicity, urban, rural, coastal, inland, and on and on. U.S. conservatives are criticized for having a limited view of unity due to an us versus them mentality, which leaves little room for change or modernization.
Right. I think that Republicans and Democrats have become almost like their own tribes where they're not willing to give an inch to the other. I hope that's not going to continue. And I hope that the rhetoric becomes less incendiary as we move forward. But I don't think that Trump is doing anything but fomenting more discontent among groups of people that are already tribalized and having a hard time getting together.
The United States is proving unable to resolve a host of enormous problems. Protecting from the coronavirus pandemic, Great Depression-era levels of unemployment alongside a skyrocketing Wall Street, endemic economic inequality which has exploded in 2020, constant racial discrimination, record disharmony between genders, a Congress which is half as popular as an often deeply unpopular president, and of course, a disputed election, the third in six tries. The poll makes it clear that belief in the nation's division is not a partisan issue, as Democrats, Republicans, and Independents all agree in similar proportions. Americans can only seem to agree on one thing, that they really, deeply disagree. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
The Israeli military has hit several locations in the besieged Gaza Strip with air raids and artillery fire. The attacks struck sites in Gaza City and Khan Yunis, as well as an outpost belonging to the Hamas resistance movement in Rafah. The Israeli military claimed that all the attacks targeted Hamas ammunition sites and underground infrastructure. The regime said that they were responding to rocket fire from the Strip. No Palestinian group has confirmed or claimed responsibility for the rocket attack. The aggression comes after similar strikes on Gaza last week over alleged Palestinian rocket fire. Israel frequently carries out attacks on the enclave, citing different pretexts. Gaza has been under the Israeli siege since 2007. The regime has also waged three wars on the coastal strip ever since. Lebanese President Michel Aoun has criticized normalization of ties between Israel and several Arab states. It says the move implies a tacit acceptance of losing Jerusalem al-Quds and the occupied Golan Heights. Aoun was referring to the U.S. brokered deals under which the UAE, Bahrain, and Sudan agreed to establish relations with Israel. The deals met with fierce condemnation from across the Muslim world. Palestinians have called it a stab in the back. A co-founder of the Free Palestine Movement, Paul LaRudy, says that Arab people, unlike the rulers, do not like the idea of normalizing relations with Tel Aviv and back the Palestinian cause.
The Arab world is dividing itself into those who are normalizing, so-called normalizing relationship with Israel, and those who are opposed to it and are in solidarity with Palestinians. The ones who are normalizing their relationship with Israel do not claim to be in solidarity with the Palestinians. In fact, some of them are saying it's time to forget about this. The Palestinians have to make their deal with Israel. I don't think there's a single Arab people anywhere in the Arab world that likes the idea of normalization, or that is not in solidarity with the Palestinians. So the question is whether the leadership is going to go along with the views of and the sympathies of their own people. And in the case of Sudan, for example, they really twisted the arms of the leadership there. Threatening, making threats, which the United States often does in these cases, and at the same time offering all sorts of benefits.
Tehran has denounced the U.S. Secretary of State's recent visit to an Israeli settlement in the occupied Palestinian territory, saying that it was in line with Washington's anti-Palestinian stance.
The trip to the occupied Palestinian territories by the U.S. regime's Secretary of State is a bitter issue. If it weren't for the treason of the rulers of a handful of Arab countries, the U.S. diplomat would not have been emboldened to blatantly travel there and breach U.N. Security Council resolutions, and would not have disobediently approved of Israel's anti-human rights moves.
He said the treason of certain Arab states and the shamelessness of White House rulers are two sides of the same coin. The spokesman noted that those who set the stage for the U.S. to act so blatantly should be held accountable. Here's the few regional countries that have signed normalization deals with the Israeli regime to return to regional cooperation. The spokesman also called on the Muslim world to remain committed to the cause of the Palestinians. Concern is growing over the coronavirus pandemic, while the deadly virus is taking its toll on countries in East Asia. South Korea reported more than 300 new cases for a fifth straight day on Sunday. That brings the total infections there to more than 30,700. More than 500 people in total have also lost their lives to the deadly virus. Authorities warning that stricter rules could be imposed if the trend continues to threaten the highly populated capital of Seoul and surrounding areas. Japan also said that it may reimpose attendance limits for sports and other large events as a new infection cases in the country climbed to 2,600. That's a daily record since the beginning of the disease. The overall infections in Japan now passed 130,000 with almost 2,000 deaths. In Armenia, people have taken to the streets again in the capital Yerevan, calling for the resignation of Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan. Demonstrators also voiced opposition to the recent deal with Azerbaijan over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. Yerevan has witnessed several such rallies since Pashinyan signed the ceasefire agreement. The accord announced on November 10th secured territorial advances for Azerbaijan into the disputed region. Pashinyan called the deal a disaster, but said that he was forced to sign it to stave off a defeat. The Russian brokered truce halted military action in and around Nagorno-Karabakh. Some 2,000 Russian peacekeeping troops are deployed to the region to monitor the ceasefire. Russia's permanent representative to the international organizations in Vienna says that it's not prudent to mix up Iran's nuclear dossier with other issues. In a tweet, Mikhail Olyanov dismissed as wrong the idea of normalizing the situation around the Iran nuclear deal would require to address the country's missile program or its regional behavior. Olyanov stressed that other issues have a chance to be settled only in a broader regional context. Washington withdrew from the landmark nuclear accord in 2018, launching a sanctions campaign against the Islamic Republic to force it to renegotiate the deal. Iran has repeatedly refused the renegotiation of the nuclear deal. In France, people have taken to the streets of capital Paris for the second time in a week to protest a new law called the Global Security Law. It makes it more difficult to film and publish pictures of police officers. Now, despite a large mobilization of the French civil society, a majority in parliament voted in favor of the controversial law. Our correspondent has more from Paris.
Thousands in Paris, tens of thousands all over France are protesting for the second time in a week against the global security law. This new law has been voted in the French parliament and makes it illegal to film and publish images of police officers. For these demonstrators, this new law is a violation of the right to inform.
We will no longer be able to film policemen in action and to put them on the social networks, which is of course very dangerous because nowadays there is a real issue in France about violence from the policemen.
Even at the very beginning of the sanitary crisis, with the total confinement, the police were controlling everybody, asking for their certificate to be able to leave their residence, you know, even though it could eventually be defendable from a sanitary point of view. Now, it has nothing to do with that. This proposed law is not directly connected to the sanitary crisis at all, and they are just giving more powers to the police.
Earlier this week, the police used tear gas and water cannon when protesters took the street in front of the French parliament. With the new law, it will become illegal to film this kind of police intervention. During the Yellow Vest movement, videos have been used in judicial investigation concerning police violence. With this law, the French state can more easily hide illegal actions committed by police officers. It can also more easily hide scandals, which opens the door for abuse of power.
For us, this law doesn't only concern journalists. During the Yellow Vest movement, we have seen an explosion of police violence. One of the important arms to fight against this is the ability to film the police violence and to denounce it. So this law is also against us, not only against journalists. There is also a surveillance of demonstrators by drones.
The French government says they want a better protection for their police force. But the new French law is seriously criticized by the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, as well as by a large spectrum of the French civil society, journalist associations, trade unions, political parties and human rights defenders. 1 year of prison and 45,000 euros of penalties, that's what someone risks for publishing the face of a police officer. Many people here say that the French government is using the coronavirus crisis to limit personal and public liberties. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
Thousands of Guatemalans have taken to the streets in their biggest protest rally against the government of President Alejandro Giammattei. Police clashed with protesters after a group broke into Congress and torched part of a building by throwing projectiles. Demonstrators called for the resignation of Giammattei over legislators' approval of a controversial budget that cut educational and health spending. They're also angry at the government's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. That's while the country is still reeling from two powerful hurricanes, which hit in November, killing 60 people and destroying farms. Police have moved to break up demonstrations against racism in a formerly whites-only area of South Africa. The reaction has made the anti-racism opposition party Economic Freedom Fighters angry. And that's not the first time that authorities have reacted to such demonstrations. Hassan Saria reports from Cape Town.
There are claims of discrimination at this school that highlighted the entrenched racism which resides in the broader community here. Among the accounts, children of color were described with highly derogatory terms by teachers and fellow learners who were excluded from certain activities. And when this was protested, white individuals from the area violently attacked those raising concerns. Protesters say by perpetuating this attitude, which is reminiscent of the apartheid years, youth born under South Africa's democracy are still being taught old racial tendencies.
That we're against the racism. We're not against the white people. You must be correct with that. We're not against with white people. They are humans like us. But the way they treat us, it's like we're not humans.
But today, as before, the police were clearly set to protect the white community, blocking all efforts by the protesters to make progress. Demonstrators point to a broader issue with how the government continues to target the vulnerable.
It was just a peaceful protest because no one did anything to harm the police. We were just peacefully and then raising our voices that enough is enough. So they started to do this thing because we are black.
This is an illusion of democracy that we are getting. It's just a democracy that we have received just only to vote. But in terms of freedom, we are not free.
Scenes of a riot that we have witnessed here in this area today. Stun grenades, rubber bullets, as well as water cannons used to disperse the crowd. And so they were prevented from handing over their memorandum of demands, which of course was against racism within this area. At this point, there appears little effort by authorities to make a move against racism here. The Provincial Education Department has rejected calls by the South African Human Rights Commission for a probe or any action against teachers accused of racism. The opposition left-leaning Economic Freedom Fighters, which has led these protests, say it is this attitude that will only ensure they continue with their protests. Hassan Siria, Cape Town.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
I'm Eric Shmanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who is talking to the artist.
Listeners Special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special on this very cool and pretty Sunday, November 22nd, 2020. I'm Atef Erfani, hosting this program today. Listeners Special, the Sunday program, is a program where your views are presented through emails and letters. So, dear listeners, contact us and tell us what you think about our programs, or if you have any messages for our listeners around the world, then start. Record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard. Dear listeners of Listeners Special, this program is your program. It's your views that are important. Dear listeners, keep us company until the end of the program. You're listening to the Sunday program, Listeners Special, and I have to note that many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. As you know, these reception reports are very useful and important to us, especially to our technicians and engineers. These reception reports enable us in IRIB English Radio to provide a better service to our dear listeners throughout the world. All of you who have sent in a reception report normally will be receiving a QSL card from us in IRIB English Radio. But unfortunately these days, as you know, with the outbreak of coronavirus pandemic around the world, please don't expect a QSL card from IRIB English Radio. I mean, a paper QSL card. As you may know, sending any material on behalf of IRIB English Radio is temporarily halted due to the outbreak of coronavirus. Anyway, here, I truly appreciate those of our dear listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports, including Shivanupol from India, Dimitri Elagin from Russia, and Rasem Ben Brahim from Tunisia. Shivanupol, Dimitri Elagin, and Rasem Ben Brahim, we want you to know that how much we in IRIB English Radio support, you know, value your support and commitment to our radio. Also, a million thanks to those of our listeners who have kindly sent us emails and letters, which I mentioned some of their names here, and later during our program, I will read their emails and letters, including Hector Fria Jorge from Chile, Mahfouz from India, KP Munir from UAE has sent us an email, Divan Rafiqul Islam from Bangladesh has sent us an email, and Konstantin Barsenkov from Russia. Dear listeners, stay with us until the end of the program. I will be back with all these kind messages just in seconds after the music. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, and I'm here with a lot of emails and letters from around the world, including from an email from Hector Fria Jorge from Chile. Hector Fria Jorge from Chile is one of our regular listeners who says, I remember when I was a kid around 10 years old, one day I noticed a big radio with a green light and changing colors. It also had a screen which would show the dial where the signals were propagated. New York, London, Bonn, Madrid, Sydney, Tehran, and thus several names of big cities. Today, after over 50 years, it fills me with joy to know that through radio, people like me could connect and get to know different cultures and customs of many countries. At the age of 23, I started listening regularly to the radio, and I discovered that with a special antenna for shortwave that wooden box could turn into a magic box. That radio was just like a window that could show you beyond the geographical borders. The shortwave has brought me a great deal of knowledge about the countries around the world because this window has allowed me to travel without moving from my desk to know firsthand news and to discover the truth. Ah, well, greetings to you, Hector Friahofre from Chile, and many thanks for writing this really, really inspiring email to IRIB English Radio. You know, I'm really filled with joy after I read your email. Your description of radio and its development to shortwave radio was so interesting. Personally, it made my day reading your email describing shortwave radio and generally radio. It's an honor to receive such interesting and exciting email from you, Hector Friahofre from Chile. And thank you for sharing your experience about listening to radio and its development to IRIB English Radio. Many thanks for writing this email to us. Hector Friahofre from Chile, we are waiting for more emails from you. We're looking forward to hearing from you very soon in the future. Please share more experiences of yours about listening to radio to us in upcoming emails, and tell us which programs in IRB English Radio you like the best. Thank you again. We are waiting forward to hearing from you very soon. Also, here we have an email from India. This email is from Mahfuz. Mahfuz says, please convey my regards to your entire colleagues. Hope you're doing well. I'm also fine. In the attachment, I'm sending IRIB English Program Monitoring Report. Please review the monitoring report. I will be grateful to you if you can issue a printed QSL card for me. Please visit my Facebook group page. There, I post my QSL cards collection from all around the world. Thank you for your nice cooperation in advance. Thanks and best regards. Mahfuz from India, first of all, greetings to you and many thanks for writing to IRIB English Radio. We also hope you're doing fine. Yes, we've received the attachment you mentioned in your email. As you said, this is the IRIB English Program Monitoring Report and review. We also received that report, and we are grateful for that. And thank you for mentioning your Facebook group page. We will review that also. And regarding your request about sending paper QSL card, as I mentioned at the introduction of our program, sending any material during these days, the outbreak of coronavirus, and regarding the observation of health protocols about sending any item to other countries, sending any promotional item like souvenirs and paper QSL cards is temporarily halted on behalf of IRB English Radio. So please be patient until this disease is controlled around the world, and then we can send you and other listeners around the world the paper QSL cards and other promotional items. Thank you for writing this email to us, Mahfuz from India. Please write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English Radio broadcast. Dear listeners, what about a short break? Welcome back. Here we have an email from Russia. This email is from Konstantin Barsenkov. This dear friend says, thank you for your interesting programs and informative news bulletins. It's a great chance for us to hear the world news from alternative media and not just the mainstream media. Thank you all and the best wishes for you from Russia. And greetings to you, Konstantin Barsenko from Russia. I hope you're doing well. And also, it's a great pleasure for us to have you as a listener. We are so glad that you enjoyed our programs. As you said, they're interesting. And also, you said our news bulletins are informative. Thank you. Our effort in IRB English Radio has been providing our dear listeners around the world with the best and, unbiased, non-partial, and correct news from around the world. Thank you again for writing to us, Konstantin Barsenko from Russia. Write to us soon. Also, from Bangladesh, we have an email from Divan Rafiqul Islam. Divan Rafiqul Islam is one of our regular listeners who says, "Greetings to all of your staff. I have the privilege to regularly listen to your daily programs. I'm also glad to inform you that I visit your website and read daily news whenever I get the chance. I should tell you that these days, many young people in my region are becoming more and more interested in listening to radio programs, and I hope that they can send you and other radio stations their reception reports and collect QSL cards. It would be a great pleasure if you can send me few promotional materials via post in future when the coronavirus is gone. Thank you in advance." And salam and greetings to you, Divan Rafiqul Islam from Bangladesh. We're so glad that you enjoyed our programs. As you said, you enjoyed the broadcast and the website. And it's a pleasure that you read our daily news in the website and listen to IRB English Radio programs. Divan Rafiqul Islam, as you said, after the coronavirus is gone, we can get back to normal life and send you promotional items of IRB English Radio. Thank you again for writing this email to us. Write to us very soon. We are looking forward to hearing from you soon, and in your upcoming letters, tell us which programs you like the best. Dear listeners, after a short break, I will be back with other emails and letters from our dear listeners from around the world. Stay tuned. Welcome back. Here we have an email from KP Munir from the UAE. KP Munir says, "Assalamu alaikum. Hope you're doing well. Yesterday, I had the chance to listen to your English language broadcast, and I heard the news program. Nice news broadcast. Please find the attached audio clip of the program I've listened. Please verify and acknowledge." KP Munir from the UAE, salam and greetings to you. And thank you for writing to IRIB English Radio. We are very glad that you've received the signals of IRIB English Radio in your country. And as you said, you heard a piece of news and you attached the program you listened. Thank you again. Write to us soon. KP Munir from the UAE. Well, dear listeners, time tells me that here we've reached to the section of this week's interview, which is conducted with one of our regular listeners. Hope you'll enjoy it.
My name's Christopher Lewis. I've been a listener to the IRIB English Radio for nearly 16, 17 years, probably a little bit longer now. I'm just interested in shortwave broadcasts in general, Iran in particular, and events in and around the Middle East. I've just had a general interest in shortwave for a long, long time, and very interested in cultures as well. First and foremost, with IRIB, I like listening to the news. That's one feature I've always looked forward to listening to, and also news commentaries, because it's not just international news, it's regional and local news that I'm interested in, and IRIB, for me, news is put together very, very well. It's gathered very well. It's accurate. And it's and also other programs afterwards, news analysis, commentary about events in general, world events, and Iran's view on what's happening in the world, not only close to home, but also around the globe itself. I also enjoy listeners' programs and to find out what other listeners think of IRIB and what other stations they listen to, what their view is on Iran and Iran's views about the world. As concerns the general program output, I think IRIB has got a more varied amount of programs than some Western broadcasters in the fact that a lot is fit into the one-hour broadcast time, and the time is used very, very wise. It's diverse, it's kept interesting, and it features a good about culture as well, about Iran and Iran's views on politics and Iran's relations with other countries around the world. So it's more varied program-wise, which keeps things interesting. I think it's very important as a listener that things are kept interesting, and not just rehashed all the time, which is what IRIB always manages to create an interesting listen, which has probably kept me tuned in for so long. So I just encourage everybody to carry on tuning in to IRIB, sending your reception reports, which I know are very useful to the station itself, and just carry on sending letters of support and interest and learning more about Iran and such a wonderful country it is, because it's got a lot of culture to offer, and one day it's on my bucket list to visit. I'd love to come and visit Iran.
And here we wrap up this week's edition of Listener's Special. Many thanks for being with us, and goodbye.
Listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to EnglishRadio@irib.ir. That is one word, EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00982122013720. Once again, our phone number is 00982122013720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
The debate.
and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. More victims of the U.S.-led coalition of war on terror are being identified. This time, 39 Afghan civilians who were killed in 2002 are most likely to have been killed illegally by Australian special forces. Now, this is according to a four-year investigation by Australian Defence Force after complaints by Afghan and Australian nationals to investigate. So what does it all mean now? Stay with us as we take a look at this on this debate.
The Australian military is under fire following the release of a damning report this week that has found credible evidence of war crimes in Afghanistan. The long-awaited report, based on a four-year inquiry, has found evidence that Australian special forces killed dozens of Afghan prisoners, farmers, or other civilians. The findings of the inquiry carried out by the Australian Defence Force reveal a twisted and extreme warrior culture among the elite of the Australian armed forces who were deployed to Afghanistan. The commandos were supposed to fight militants thousands of kilometers away from Australia, but many of them now stand accused of engaging in a methodical campaign to kill unarmed Afghans and conceal it. In one instance, the inquiry has found evidence that platoon commanders told junior soldiers to get their first kill by shooting prisoners. An academic who carried out the initial research into the atrocities believes that they were, quote, deliberate, repeated, and targeted war crimes. The inquiry findings show that some of the soldiers who are accused of committing these war crimes are still serving in the Australian military. The report has been highly redacted, and many details of the atrocities remain unknown. But its authors have admitted that they probably failed to uncover all crimes committed during a period of time under investigation. They have recommended a mechanism to collect and assess further allegations of atrocities in Afghanistan. The findings are deeply embarrassing for the Australian government, which is a vociferous critic of rights abuses around the world. The government initially tried to suppress whistleblowers and local media that had tried to bring the alleged war crimes to public attention. Australian authorities tried hard to keep a lid on this story when it first emerged in 2017. That year, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation published shocking allegations of unlawful killings of unarmed Afghans, including children, based on leaked military documents. The Australian Federal Police raided the office of the national broadcaster and tried in vain to prosecute the journalist who blew the whistle on the killings. The story now seems to have turned into a major scandal. The latest findings are a painful legacy of America's longest war. The U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in October 2001 has resulted in nearly two decades of war. A very large number of Afghan civilians, including children, have lost their lives in American and U.S.-led airstrikes and operations. The U.S.-led military campaign has failed to wipe out militancy. It instead devastated Afghanistan and has left the country grappling with an endless list of problems. The United States itself is being investigated for possible war crimes in Afghanistan. The ICC probe began earlier this year after a preliminary report found reasons to believe war crimes had been committed during the war. U.S. President Donald Trump, who was infuriated by the investigation, imposed sanctions on the court. His decision drew worldwide condemnation. Observers believe that the U.S. must have a lot to worry about as the International Criminal Court investigates its actions during the war in Afghanistan.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, author and lecturer Jonathan Fryer out of London and journalist and historian Brett Yonkers out of Hasselt. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, let's start off in London with Jonathan. What did you think about the findings of this investigation, and were you surprised at all that these type of abuses had taken place?
Obviously, the reports are very shocking indeed, even though it was somewhat redacted. There's enough information in there to really raise huge questions over the whole nature of the operations of the special forces of the Australian Army in Afghanistan. The good thing is the report has come out, and also that the head of the Defence Services has apologised, but of course an apology is nothing like enough. There will be prosecutions, and that must be prosecutions, but it shouldn't only be the younger soldiers who end up being prosecuted, because I think clearly the command chain goes higher, including perhaps into the political sphere of the leadership in Australia, and there needs to be a very, very careful investigation as to exactly how this sort of policy came about, where, as was mentioned in the introductory piece, for example, there would be what was called blooding. Young recruits just arriving would be told to shoot a prisoner in order to get them used to killing civilians, which is clearly a war crime.
Well, Brett, in the report it states about that war culture that our guest in London just was mentioning amongst these elite troops and the way some troops were anxious to get their first kill. And what exactly does that say? I mean, does it appear to you that this would just be something isolated and these troops were not following orders? Do you think this is just isolated with these individuals, or do you think that the responsibility goes further up the ladder?
I think it definitely runs further than just the rank-and-file troops that have committed these atrocities. Indeed, as has been mentioned and as was written in the report, in many cases, these were initiation rituals of a kind. You know, young soldiers, grunts who come into combat for the first time, who are being told to basically get their hands dirty immediately in one of the most gruesome ways possible by murdering either civilians or unarmed prisoners. And, of course, this order had to come from someone. And so this order came most likely from the officers. And the officer staff, of course, responds to an even higher brass of higher officers and higher-ups that I think it's very unlikely, if this was such a relatively commonplace occurrence, as seems to be hinted in the report, it would be very unlikely that the higher brass did not know about this and that the military leadership was in the dark about this. I think this is, on the contrary, this speaks to a very typical and very problematic culture of extreme nationalism and jingoism in not just Australia, and not Australia in particular even, but in the Western armed forces that have been active in the Middle East in general and in Central Asia in the past few decades. This is a typical sort of mentality that you see also expressed in the United States military, I believe also in the British military, and in many of the troops that and armies in general, army command structures of the nations that are active in the conflict in, for example, Afghanistan, but also in Iraq. Because what you see is a form of result, what I would call a result of decades of massive propaganda, of dehumanization of the enemy, and not just of the enemy, but of the people living in the country. Mm-hmm. This is no longer crimes committed against people who fought necessarily against these troops. These are not just Taliban soldiers or Daesh or whatever extremists that are being targeted. These are very often civilians. There have been numerous cases of footage being published in which soldiers, usually American soldiers, are traveling through the countryside in Afghanistan and just murdered some farmers or some goat herders or shepherds along the way, because they know that there is very little chance of this really going viral, let's say, because for them these are just illiterate peasants that they mm-hmm. can do with whatever they want. This is a problem of mentality, a problem of mindset
okay.
that's all pervasive in the military structure of many Western societies.
What about that, Jonathan? I mean, do you think in general this U.S.-led coalition, and in this case we're talking about the Australian side of things, but in general that, as our other guest was alluding to, that they have this superiority type of attitude when dealing with the other, especially, for example, dealing with Afghans, and basically not even looking at these people as human sometimes?
Yes, I'm sure that's right. Brett is absolutely correct to focus on the dehumanization of the other in these sorts of conflict situations. The fact that they're of different ethnicity, the fact that they are Muslims in most cases, also plays into this narrative of some countries, including the United States, that see them therefore as the enemy, whether they are actually armed resistance or terrorists or just ordinary farmers going about their own business. And there seems to have been such an acceptance of that situation in Afghanistan, by no means only by the Australians, that poor Afghans who were confronted with these sorts of situations often didn't even complain because they thought it would be a complete waste of time. that there was a culture of impunity, and well-armed Westerners, whether they were Australians, Americans, or indeed British, would always be able to have their way, and that the best way to escape problems was to remain quiet and out of sight. So there is a real problem, and it's not only in Afghanistan. We saw incidents like that in Iraq as well. For example, the way that Americans treated people in Abu Ghraib prison, you may recall, appalling scenes of degradation and dehumanization. And this is something that really Western countries, including Britain, have got to come to terms with and to stamp out.
Well, Brett, the acts that, actually crimes that we're talking about happened 18 years ago. Why do you think it's taken so long to expose this when Afghan families have been complaining from the very beginning about the abuses of U.S.-led coalition forces there?
Well, I think it's a combination of general problems, of course, getting information like this out to the world, but combined with a far more important and far more destructive problem being the policy of keeping a lid on everything. As has been said in the beginning of the report, indeed, by the reporter on the scene, is that when ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, reported on this in 2017 in the first place, their offices were raided, and the journalist was, for a while, threatened basically to be treated as, for example, Julian Assange or Edward Snowden were when they basically blew a whistle on certain crimes that were being committed in the country or by people of the country's nationality. So this is, when you see that this is how far they will go in broad daylight in Australia already, you can only begin to imagine how far they will go in order to keep this under, to swipe this under the rug when it's being said in Afghanistan. You can imagine if a farmer or a shepherd in Afghanistan goes to complain to the authorities, to the police forces, even if it's the Afghan local authorities, the chances are very high, of course, that this complaint will be noticed by the occupying forces, the foreign forces that are being talked about, in this case, the Australians. So, of course, there is no evidence of a violent crackdown on people who are trying to explain their story. But I don't think it would be very far-fetched to believe that these people are likely threatened with violence, threatened with more dangerous acts if they try to get their story known. And indeed, as Mr. Fryer said, the problem is that many of these people, after a while, probably just gave up trying to complain about it in general, because what's the point of trying to get your story out if you know the lid will be trying to, they will try to put the lid on it constantly. And that result is that, fortunately, we have had some good journalists now, Australian journalists, who have finally decided to publish the story. But it will, of course, it has taken years for these people to dig through the mud in order to get what they needed in order to publish this report. That's the result of it.
Right. And Jonathan, at the end of the day, do you think that any measures will really be taken against these soldiers? Will these soldiers be charged with murder, you think?
Well, I think certainly there will be prosecutions. Whether they will be found guilty and sentenced to long periods of prison is another matter. But I think there certainly will be prosecutions. It would be very difficult for the Australian government to avoid putting some troops on trial because of the public opinion and international opinion, which would demand that some people have to bear responsibility. As I mentioned earlier, the problem is how high up the line should this go? Because obviously the higher it goes, then the less likelihood there is of any proper retribution against the people who are responsible for the policy, which does stem into the whole of the war on terror narrative. In other words, that if you're in a situation where you're dealing against with terrorists, that anything goes, and that means that ordinary civilians who probably have nothing whatsoever to do with any extreme group get caught up in this. So I think it's very important for international law that Australia takes a stand, and that other countries, including Britain, also look at their own special forces and really see whether this problem is wider and whether how it can be rooted out.
Well, Brett, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison now has apologized directly to Afghan President Ashraf Ghani about what he called these abuses. But what does that mean at the end of the day? What do you think is going to happen?
Of course, the problem is that it's very easy to apologize for something that happened. The question here is, of course, if you not just, you know, talk the talk, but also walk the walk. And that's something that Australia has to prove now. They have to show to the world that they take this seriously, that these people will be tried for the crimes that they have committed. And indeed, this in many cases, this would definitely include the charge of murder or at least manslaughter, and not just, you know, crimes that, not just like abuses that were committed in the time of war, because that makes it sound like there are circumstances that would justify these actions. And I don't think these things are justifiable, no matter under which circumstances they happen. The other problem, of course, is the question remains how far Afghanistan, the government of Afghanistan, will go in order to pursue this, because we have seen time and again that the Afghan government is not always necessarily a stable government, and is in many cases and in many ways very dependent, of course, on these foreign troops that are keeping it in power. There is very often a problem of popular support that is very much lacking, popular support for this government. And as a result, it is very difficult, I think, for the it is very unlikely, I mean, to hope that these Afghan politicians will really try to pressure what they perceive as their Western allies into really pursuing this very much. Of course, I could be mistaken, and I hope I will be. But this goes much further than just apologizing and saying sorry that this happened. These people have to be brought to justice. Recompensation should be paid to the families of the victims. And in general, actually, recompensation should be paid to Afghanistan, because this is running into their hundreds of billions of dollars that Afghanistan has been suffering in both economic terms and, of course, in manpower and in population, a lot of people that have been massacred as a result of this unnecessary war ever since 2001. Mm-hmm. So this is a general problem that has to be solved in a way that is much more fundamental. And that is something in which I fear that is unlikely to happen, because if we bring it back to the leader of this coalition, the United States, we have to bear in mind the United States has never even recompensated Vietnam for the crimes they have committed there 40, 50 years ago. So right. The chances that they could do this anytime soon to Afghanistan are, I'm afraid, quite slim.
Well, Jonathan, are there double standards in the way U.S. allies are held responsible for war crimes as opposed to those fighting against the U.S.?
Well, I mean, a war crime is a war crime, whoever carries it out, whether it's the U.S. or any of their allied forces in a country like Afghanistan, or any extremist group. In the news bulletin, you mentioned today's attacks from Daesh on Kabul again, yet more civilians killed in that attack. And certainly they need to be held to account as well, but it's much more difficult because, of course, you can't often identify where is the chain of command and who are really carrying out these atrocities. But the whole idea of setting up the International Criminal Court several years ago, which Trump so dislikes, is the idea that there are international standards, and these should apply to governments, to armies, and to non-state actors. And it's very important, I think, that this principle be bolstered by appropriate judicial action, and that the climate of impunity in a war situation is removed, because surely in the 21st century we should have realized that it's no longer possible to justify